that idea from?" said Teacher tartly, and it was the first time Gideon had heard him give even a little reproof. "I do not know. We are in a sacred space. Imperial law is based on the writ of the Emperor, and here the Emperor is the only law. No writ, no interpretation. I gave you his rule. There is no other." "But natural law, the laws against murder and theft, what prevents us from stealing one another's keys through intimidation, blackmail, or deception? What would stop someone from waiting for another necromancer and their cavalier to gather a sufficient number of keys, then taking them by force?" Teacher said, "Nothing."
Coronabeth had finally dropped her hand from Palamedes's shoulder. She looked over at the second house. A somber understanding was dawning on Captain Deuteris's face, and Lieutenant Dias's was as inscrutable as ever. And then she looked at Palamedes, whose expression was that of a soldier who had just heard the call to the front. There was a shields-up twist to his mouth and eyes. Corona breathed. "Ianthe has to know," and fled from the room. Her leaving was a little like an eclipse. The evening sun seemed to cool with her, and the duller electric lights vibrated to life with her passing. In an almost inexcusably banal act, a white-belted skeleton appeared from the kitchen with two steaming plates of the poached pale meat and root vegetables. One of these was put in front of Gideon, and she remembered that she was ravenous. She ignored the knife and fork that the skeleton carefully laid at either side of the plate, as nicely as anyone with a soul would have, and started cramming food into her mouth with her hands. Teacher was still bracing his hands around his cup, his expression more final than troubled, too serene to be worried, but still somehow thoughtful, a little woebegone.
"Teacher," said Palamedes, "when did Magnus the Fifth ask you for a facility key?"
"Why, the night he died," said Teacher. "He and little Jean-Marie, after the dinner. But she didn't take hers. Magnus asked me to hold on to it, for safekeeping. She was not happy. I thought perhaps the Fourth would come and ask for it today. Then again, if I could prevent either of those two children from going down to that place, I would."
He looked up through the skylight at the deepening dusk, the curls of steam from his mug slowly thinning away.
"Oh, Emperor of the Nine Houses," he said to the knight, "Necro Lord Prime, God who became man and man who became God, we have loved you these long days. The 16 gave themselves freely to you. Lord, let nothing happen that you did not anticipate."
There came the noisy clatter of bowls. It was the second who, instead of sitting back down, were collating their cutlery and pushing in their chairs. They left in taut silence, single file, without a glance back at anyone remaining. Camilla sat down opposite Gideon as the skeleton put the second plate in front of her, and she used her knife and fork, though not with any great elegance. The necromancer of the Sixth was rubbing at his temples. His cavalier looked at him, and he offhandedly took a few bites of his meat and his vegetables. But then he stopped pretending and put down his fork.
"Come," he said. "Ninth, when you're finished, come with me."
It didn't take long for Gideon to finish, as in any case she hadn't much bothered to chew. She stared with glassy eyes at Camilla the Sixth's plate. Camilla, who had finished most of hers, rolled her eyes and pushed her leftovers to Gideon. This was an act for which she was fond of Camilla forever after. Then they both followed a stoop-shouldered Palamedes as he pushed through the door that the second had left from, down a corridor and a short flight of steps, turning a wheel on an iron door, its glass window rimed thickly with frost. This appeared to be where the priest stored anything perishable. Strings of startle-eyed frozen fish with their scales and tails intact hung like laundry on lines above steel countertops, bewildering Gideon with the reality of what she had been eating. Other, even weirder meats were stacked in alcoves to one side of the room, expiration dates labelled with spidery handwriting. A fan blasted the area with toe-curlingly cold air as Gideon wrapped her cloak more thickly around her. Barrels lined some of the other walls. Fresh vegetables, obviously just picked for tonight's chopping, lay on a granite board. A skeleton was packing linen-wrapped wheels of some waxy white substance into a box. A door led away from this fridge. It opened, and the second emerged. They did not look happy to see the newcomers. Captain Deuterus said heavily,
"You're a fool, Sextus."
"I don't deserve that," said Palamedes. "You're the one who just found nothing for the second time."
"The sixth house is welcome to succeed where the second has failed."
She tugged her already perfect gloves into even glassier, unwrinkled smoothness, and flakes of ice settled on her braided head.
"The community needs this over and done with," she said. "It needs someone who can take command, end this, and send everyone back in one piece. Will you consider working with me?"
"No," said Palamedes.
"I'm not bribing you with goods and services. I'm asking you to choose stability."
"I can't be bribed with goods and services," said Palamedes. "But I can't be bribed with moral platitudes either. My conscience doesn't permit me to help anyone do what we have all embarked upon."
"You don't understand,"
Palamedes said savagely. "Captain, God help you when you understand. My only consolation is that you won't be able to put any responsibility on my head."
The cohort necromancer closed her eyes and seemed to count slowly to five. Then she said,
"I'm not interested in veiled threats or vagaries. Will you answer honestly if I ask you how many keys you have?"
"I would be a fool to answer," he said. "But I can tell you that I have fewer than you think. I am not the only one who came here wanting to be a lictor, Captain. You've just been too damn slow on the uptake."
Lieutenant Dias's fingers closed slowly and deliberately around the hilt of her functional rapier. Camilla's fingers were already on hers. Her other hand was on the hilt she kept at her left hip, the embossed grip of her dagger. Gideon, who had just eaten 1¼ dinners, felt unbelievably unready for whatever was about to go down. She was relieved when the necromancer of the second said,
"Leave it. The die is cast."
And both women pushed past them. Palamedes led the other two cavaliers through the nondescript door to another nondescript room, past the cooling larder. This room held big shelves at one end, stacked one atop the other. A few tables with wheels from which the rubber was peeling off in big strips were parked in a corner. These tables were high and long enough to hold a whole person lying flat. It was the morgue, though a more impersonal and featureless morgue Gideon could not imagine. Gideon said, "How long have you known about the keys?"
"Long enough," said Palamedes, hooking his fingers underneath the lid of a morgue shelf. "Your Nonagesimus confirmed it with me after the fifth were killed. Yes, I know you've known the whole time."
"Oh, exquisite." Herohark had kept Palamedes Sextus in a loop that didn't include Gideon. She felt angry. Then she felt bereft. Then she felt angry again. This felt like being hot and cold at once. Totally heedless of her, the sixth necromancer continued,
"I meant what I said, though. There are precious few keys left. The feces hits the fans starting now. Cam, did you bring the box?"
Gideon said, "What do you mean?" Camilla had dropped her heavy bag next to her necromancer, and he was riffling through it with one hand, pulling the shelf out with the other. Well-greased struts smoothly produced a body covered with a thin white sheet, murmuring into view feet first. Palamedes pulled the sheet up from the feet all the way to the abdomen and started carefully feeling the legs through the clothes. It was Magnus, and he had not improved since Gideon had last seen him. She regretted again eating 1¼ dinners.
"Put it this way," he said eventually.
palpating her hip. Up till now, I'd assumed everyone was being remarkably civil. If the initial method of obtaining keys was cleverness and hard work, the way forward from here will be either what you just saw, heavy-handed alliance attempts, or worse. Why do you think the Eighth picked a fight with the Seventh? Because he's a prig and a nasty weirdo, said Gideon. Intriguingly put, said Palamedes. But although he is a prig and a nasty weirdo, Dulcinea Septimus has two keys. Silas has made her a target.
This was all getting unreal, a weird mathematics that she hadn't even been counting. But she was still ninth enough to hold her tongue. She said instead, No offence, but what the hell are you doing? He had taken a fingerful of jelly out of a little tub Camilla had proffered. He was rubbing it over, bizarrely enough, the dull gold hoop of Magnus Quinn's wedding ring. With a stick of grease, he made two marks above and below the band of metal, and then held his hand over it like someone cupping a flame. Palamedes closed his eyes and, after a pregnant pause, steam began to curl above his knuckles. All at once, he muttered crossly to himself and took his hand away. This time, the grease went beneath the ring, and he started to ease it off the sad, dead finger.
I need more contact, he said to his cavalier. This touched the keyring, but there's too much jumble. And to Gideon, Our reputation doesn't precede us, I see. Thanagy attaches to more than just the body, Ninth. Psychometry can track the thanagy lingering in objects, when you get to it early and when there's a strong association. Give me the scissors. I'm going to take some of his pockets.
What are you...
Quinn's key ring, Ninth, said Palamedes, as though her question was really hopelessly obvious. There was nothing on the bodies yesterday. The second came to look, but they haven't got my resources.
That or they took the evidence, said his cavalier gloomily, but her adept counted,
not their style. Anyway, if I couldn't find anything after yesterday's examination, they wouldn't.
Don't get cocky, Warden.
I won't. But I'm fairly sure here.
Gideon said, But, hold up. Magnus had only just picked up his facility key the night, you know, he hadn't reached any challenge labs. The facility key was all he had. Who'd take that?
That's precisely what I want to know, said Palamedes.
He dropped the wedding ring into a small bleached pouch that Camilla was holding open, and then took a tiny pair of scissors and started clipping at the dead man's trousers.
Your vow of silence is conveniently variable, Ninth. I'm very grateful.
Turns out I'm variably penitent. Hey, you should be talking to Nona Jesimus.
If I wanted to talk to Nona Jesimus, I'd talk to Nona Jesimus, he said. Or I'd talk to a brick wall because, honestly, your necromancer is a walking Ninth House cliché. You're at least only half as bad.
Palamedes glanced up at her. His eyes really were extraordinary, like cut grey rock or deep weather atmosphere. He cleared his throat and he said,
How much would you do for the Lady Septimus?
Gideon was glad of the paint. She was thrown off balance, unsure of her footing. She said,
Oh, she's been kind to me. What's your interest in Lady Septimus? She's been kind to me. Said Palamedes.
They stared at each other with a kind of commingled weariness and embarrassed suspicion, skirting around something juvenile and terrible.
The Eighth is both determined and dangerous.
Protesilaus the Seventh is uncomfortably hench, though. She's not alone. Camilla spoke up. The man's a glorified orderly. His hand's never on his rapier. First instincts to punch, and he moves like a sleepwalker.
Just bear witness, said Palamedes. Just keep her in mind.
The scissors went snip, snip, and tiny squares of fabric were added to a new linen bag. With more reverence than she'd given him credit for, He had just given a corpse an invasive massage and stolen its jewellery. Palamedes softly pulled the sheet back over the abdomen and legs of Magnus V. He said, quite gently,
"We'll get to the bottom of this one, if you give us a little time."
And Gideon realized he was speaking to the body. Gideon suddenly ached to hear one of the Fifth's terrible jokes, if only because it would be a refreshing trip back to the status quo. She had to leave. Her hand was on the door. But something in her made her look back and say, "What happened to them, Sextus?"
"Violent head and body trauma," he said.
For a moment, he seemed to hesitate, and then he turned his laser-sharp gaze on her.
"What I do know is, it wasn't just a fall."
His cavalier said lowly, warningly,
"Warden?" "What good is silence now?" he said to her, and then to Gideon. "Their wounds contained extraordinarily tiny bone fragments. The fragments weren't homogeneous. They were samples from many different osseous sources, which is indicative of..."
What it was indicative of was interrupted by a small sound from beyond the door. The noise of skeletons packing things away had disappeared a long time ago. This was the noise of the door wheel being quietly spun. Gideon threw open the door to the cooling room, which Camilla burst into with her sidearm drawn. A hemline was escaping through the wheel-operated portal to the cooler, which had been left open in haste. Gideon and Palamedes stood, watching the door creak forlornly in the cold air. The hemline had been blue embroidery, and the pattering feet around the size of a crappy teen's.
"Poor dumb kids," Gideon said, "all of 4 years their elder."
"Do you think so?"
said Palamedes, surprising her.
"I don't. I often find myself wondering how dangerous they really are."
Chapter 22
That evening, Heroharc had still not returned. Gideon busied herself with catching up on her training exercises, frustrated by her sore muscles, which wanted to pack it in after the first 100 push-ups. She spent a long time doing her solo drills, the automatic litany of grip and guard, flexing into hand positions while staring out the window into the drooping black night. And then, pretty certain that Hero wasn't returning, she got out her longsword and did it all again. Having two hands on the grip was precisely the thing that Iglamine had told her not to do, but it felt so good that by the end she was happy as a child. Hero never came back. Gideon was used to this by now. Seized with sudden experimental courage, she filled up the uncanny tub in the bathroom from the hot liquid tap. When nothing jumped out at her, Gideon sat there in it with water all the way up to her chin. It was incredible. The strangest thing she had ever felt in her life. Like being buoyed on a warm current, like being slowly boiled. And she worried, irrationally, whether water could get inside you and make you sick. All her paint came off and floated in long, dirty flecks in the water. When she put soap in the water, oily rainbow slicks shone across the top. In the end, suspicious of how clean it really got you, she went and stood in the sonic for 20 seconds, but she smelled incredible. When her hair dried, it stood up on end, and it took a lot of effort to get it flat again. The bath was soporific. For the first time since she'd come to Canaan House, Gideon was truly content to lie down in her nest, get out a magazine, and do absolutely nothing for half an hour. 9 dreamless hours later, she woke up with the pages stuck to her face via a thin sealant of drool. She said, peeling it off her face, and,
"Hero?"
As it turned out, in the next room, Hero was curled up in bed with the pillows over her head and her arms sticking out. Haphazardly flung laundry was piled next to the wardrobe door. The sight filled Gideon with a sensation that she had to admit was relief. She said,
"Wake up, Ass Munch. I want to yell at you about keys."
But this imperative did not have the desired effect.
"The white key is now with your precious Septimus, as per the agreement," snapped Harrow, then pulled the covers over her head. "Now go away and shrivel."
"This does not satisfy me, Nonagesimus."
Harrow slithered more deeply underneath the covers like a bad black snake and refused to get up. It was hopeless pushing further. This freed Gideon to dress in relative peace and quiet, paint without critique, and leave their quarters feeling unusual amounts of peace with the world. She realized she was being followed somewhere down the long, sweeping staircase that led to the atrium, a peripheral blur huddled in doorways, still when she was still, making tiny movements when she was in motion. The mouldering floorboards creaked wetly underfoot. At last, Gideon spun around, her rapier drawn in one long fluid line forward and her gauntlet already half-snapped onto her fingers, and was presented with the wild young face of Isaac.
"Stop," he said. "Sean wants you."
He looked ghastly. His hands were sooty, the metallic thread on his embroidered robe soiled, and somewhere along the way he'd lost at least 3 earrings. Previously, he had contrived to brush his hair up in that bleached avian crest on the top of his head, but now everything was crumpled flat. His mouth and eyes seemed emptied out, and his pupils were dilated with an amount of cortisol that said,
"I've been on edge for 3 days."
The sweet puppy fat at his cheeks only served to make him a more awful sight. Gideon cocked her head.
"Sean wants you," he repeated. "Someone's dead. You've got to come with me."
For a moment, Gideon hoped that this was a terrifically misplaced cry for attention, but Isaac had already turned away from her, dark eyes like stones. She had no choice but to follow in his wake. Isaac led her down through the dilapidated great hall, and then down the stairs to the vestibule that led through to the sparring room, and he flinched at the sight of every white-belted skeleton that crossed their path. The tapestry was still securely in place, the door still hidden. He shouldered through the other door. It must have given his elbow a hell of a bang, and pushed into the room where electric lights poured down on what had previously been a filthy, reeking pit. It was now a square of glimmering water. Gideon had seen skeletons unrolling great tracts of rubber hose into the pit room, and even beheld them slowly glurking sea-smelling liquid into the cavity. But the end result was extraordinary. The tiles gleamed with spray as Nibirius III and Coronabeth, both wearing light singlets and trunks, did laps up and down the pool. If she'd thought the bath was mad, this blew her mind. Gideon had never seen anyone swim before. Both bodies cut through the liquid with efficient, practiced strokes. She focused on the long, golden arms of Corona Tridentarius as she sliced through the water, propelling her as she hit the wall and pushed off hard with her feet. Beyond the glass doors in the sparring room, Colum the Eighth sat on a bench, polishing his targe with a soft cloth, while Lieutenant Dias knelt into a perfect lunge over and over. Isaac made a beeline for the water. He stood in front of where the Crown Princess of Ida was churning her way through the water. She slowed her pace and bobbed up to the edge of the pool, shaking water out of her ears quizzically, hair a wet and leaden amber.
"Princess Corona," he said. "Someone's dead."
The lovely face of the Princess of Ida made the exact same expression Gideon's had wanted to, which was,
"What? What?" she said.
"Sean wants you," he said dully, "specifically."
Nibirius had finished his length of the pool, too, and had struck through the water to come and see them. His swimming shirt was a lot tighter than Coronabeth's, and his 57 abdominal muscles rippled under it importantly. He gave a long and rather obvious stretch, but stopped when he realized nobody was looking.
"What's the hold-up?"
he said, rather pettishly.
You'd better hurry up, Isaac said. I promised I'd only leave her for 5 minutes. She's with the remains.
Isaac, slow down.
Corona had vaulted herself out of the water in a flash of warm golden skin and her exceedingly long legs, and Gideon made her first and only devout prayer to the locked tomb of thankfulness and joy. Corona wrapped herself in a white towel, still dripping feverishly.
Who's dead? Isaac Tartarus, what does this mean?
It means someone's dead, Isaac said curtly. If you're not coming, I'm out of here in the next 10 seconds. I'm not leaving Jean by herself.
Corona dashed over to the training room, sticking her dripping head through the door. Her cavalier was wrapping his body and head in his own white towels, sticking wet feet in his shoes. Corona Beth bothered with neither of these. By now, she was being followed by Lieutenant Dias, whose only nod to training kit involved undoing the top button of her military jacket and by the scuffed wiriness of Column the Eighth close behind. This baffled gaggle was led outside to another broad terrace, though this one had not been built with beauty in mind. They weren't far from the edge of the dock terrace. This place had possibly shared that function once. There was room for maybe one shuttle, but it was now focused on a huge steel chimney, metal flues standing up like a flagpole. It was bricked and supported all about with big stone tiles, and there were buckets of old vegetation and filthy cloths. The latter looked as though they'd been used to clean out the pool. They were emerald with verdigris and black where they weren't green. The chimney had a huge metal grate, about 2 meters tall, where you could shovel in rubbish. This grate was open, and the contents inside were still lightly smoking. Isaac came to rest in front of the incinerator, beside Jean-Marie the Fourth. He had looked stolid and dead, as though what was going on inside him had built up a thick crust, like a volcano. Jean-Marie looked like a malfunctioning electric wire. You could practically see the sparks. Her rapier was naked, and she was pacing between the incinerator and the edge, every so often whirling around in a fit as though someone might attack her from behind. Gideon was beginning to admire her sheer animal readiness. When she saw the gang of idiots that her necromancer had brought her, she was intensely displeased.
"I wanted the Ninth and Princess Coronabeth," she said. Her voice cracked.
"Everyone tagged along," said Isaac. "I didn't want to leave you. I didn't want to leave you alone."
Careless of her bare feet and her sodden clothes, Corona marched over to the first maladjusted teen.
"Sword at ease, Sir Chateau," she said kindly. "You're fine."
It was testament to Corona that the sword was lowered and slid away into the scabbard, though Jean-Marie did not take her hand off the pommel.
"What happened? What have you found?"
The Fourth said bitterly.
"The body."
Everyone clustered around. With a piece of old flagstone, Jean-Marie knocked the still-smoking grate aside so that they could all peer through. Down a short shunt, embers still glowing sooty red, there was a heap of ashes. The Cavalier of the Second picked up an iron poker from beside the incinerator and nudged the pile. The ashes were all soft and even, crumbling to a powdery white, the red lumps breaking up under pressure. There was an expectant pause as she stuck the poker into the far corners of the big expanse and then drew it away.
"It's just ashes," said Lieutenant Dias.
"A body was burnt in there," said Jean-Marie.
Column the Eighth had gotten hold of a worn rake and was using that to pull some of the stuff closer. He stuck his hand into the boiling air and scooped out hot ashes, which showed that he either cared very little for his own pain or had a supremely good poker face. He held them out for inspection. Whatever had burnt down to a sandy grey-white stuff that left grease marks on the Eighth's yellowed palms. The necromancer teen was saying listlessly,
"I can tell fresh human remains. Can't you, Princess?"
Corona hesitated. The Second butted in.
"What if they were burning bones? One of the servants may have fallen apart.
Someone could just go ask,
rumbled Column the Eighth, shocking Gideon with an inherently sensible suggestion.
Isaac didn't hear. That's rendered fat and flesh, not dry bone.
They didn't. Are the Fifth still?
Magnus and Abigail are still where they ought to be, said Jean-Marie fiercely, in the mortuary. Someone's been killed and burnt up in the incinerator.
There were long scratches down her face. She was even smudgier than her counterpart teen, if that was possible. And in that moment, she looked feral. Her curls had frizzed up into a dark brown halo, one liberally streaked with blood and something else disreputable, and her eyes were welling up from the acrid smoke. She did not look like a stable witness to anyone.
Especially not to Nabirius. He crossed his arms, shivered in the morning sun, and drawled, "These are ghost stories, doll. You're both cracking up."
"Shut it. I'm not your doll, dickhead."
"Princess, tell him those are remains."
"Burbs, shut your mouth and fix your hair," said Corona. "Don't discount this straight off the bat."
As per usual, he looked wounded and scruffed the towel around his damp hair.
"Who's discounting?" he said. "I'm not discounting. I'm just saying there's no point. No need for all this fourth house sound and fury. Anyone goes missing, we assume they're having a nap in the incinerator."
"You are being," said the second cavalier, "surprisingly blasé."
"I hope you end up in the incinerator," said Jean-Marie. "I hope whatever killed Magnus and Abigail and whoever we just found comes after you. I'd love to see your face then. How will you look when we find you, Prince Nabirius?"
Gideon pushed between them before Nabirius could round on the ash-streaked, wet-eyed teenager. She stared into the incinerator. The Cavalier of the Eighth was still poking around, and to her eye, she had to admit there was nothing to find. Whatever had been burnt here had been burnt down to greasy, bad-smelling smithereens. Particles of ash floated up from the grate like crumbling confetti, making smuts on their faces.
"Needs a bone magician," said Column, and dropped the rake. "I'm heading back."
Nabirius, who had been staring down Jean-Marie, was distracted by this. He was more eager and jovial when he said,
"You gearing up for your duel with the Seventh? The Princess and I'll rough you, naturally."
"Yes,"
said the other man without much enthusiasm.
"I'll come with. Should be interesting to see the Cav. He's not remotely like his rep, is he? Ain't ever matched him in a tournament myself."
At the exit of the Third and the Eighth Cavaliers, the Eighth looked like he wished he were deaf. The Second went too, more silently, and wiping her hands on her scarlet neckerchief. Only the teens, Gideon, and Corona were left. Corona Beth was staring into the steaming ashes, brief singlet and shorts whipping in the wind, fine dry curls of gold escaping from the wet mass of her hair. She looked troubled, which made Gideon sad, but she was also soaked right through to the skin, which made Gideon need a lie-down.
"I keep seeing things," said the necromantic teen emptily.
They turned to look at him.
"Out of the corners of my eyes, when it's night-time, I keep waking up and hearing something moving or someone standing outside our door."
He trailed off. Jean-Marie put her arm around his shoulder and pressed her sweat-streaked brown forehead to his, and both sighed defeated sighs in concert. The solace they were taking in each other was the bruising, private solace between necromancer and cavalier, and Gideon was embarrassed to be audience to it. It was only then that they seemed at all grown up to her. They looked worn down to stubs, like ground-down teeth, greyed out of their obnoxious vitality and youth. The cavalier of the Fourth House looked up at Gideon and Corona.
"I wanted you to because Magnus liked you both," she said. "So you get the warning. Don't say I didn't tell you."
Then she led Isaac away, him looking like an expectant prey animal, her like dynamite, ushering him back through the salt-warped door. Gideon was left alone with Coronabeth. The princess was closing the huge grate to the incinerator and sliding the handle down to lock it. They both beheld it silently. It did seem big enough to heave a person through, down into what, when set, would have been roaring flames. Clouds passed overhead, plunging what had been dazzling brightness into relative gloom. The clouds were fat and bluish, which Gideon had learned meant that they would soon explode into rain. She could taste it on the air, washing the prickle of smoke off her tongue. When the storm broke, it would break hard.
"This isn't just Fourth House theatrics," said Corona. "I don't think they're being reckless here. I think we're actually in trouble. A lot of trouble."
In the newfound dimness, Gideon took off her glasses and nodded. Her hood fell back, sliding down in heavy folds of black to her shoulders. The exquisite eyes of the necromancer of the third were upon her, and the doleful expression turned into a radiant smile, violet eyes crinkling up at the corners with the hugeness of the grin.
"Why, Gideon the Ninth," she exclaimed, mourning banished. "You're a ginger!"
The clouds broke later that afternoon. The rain beat at the windows like pellets, and the skeleton servants scurried around with buckets, catching the worst of the sleeting drips, putting matting down for the puddles. Apparently, Canaan House was so used to this that their response was automatic. Gideon was familiar with rain by now, but the first time she couldn't get over it. The constant pattering drove her mad all night, and she'd had no idea how anyone who lived in atmospheric weather could ever put up with it. Now it was only a murmurous distraction. To the noise of the storm, she had gone back to check on Herohark, suddenly paranoid, convinced that she had dreamt up the arms flapping out of the duvet, the short spikes of dark hair visible from under the pillow, that maybe the reverend daughter had made Gideon's youthful dreams come true by spending all night in an incinerator. But Hero hadn't even woken up. Gideon ate lunch next to a skeleton servant, carefully balancing a bucket on the table, into which fat drips fell from the windows. Ploing, ploing, ploing. The numinous dread hadn't really left her since that morning. It was almost a relief to see the shadow of Camilla Hecht fall over her bowl of soup and bread and butter. Camilla's grey hood was wet with rain. "Jewels off," she said by way of hello. "Seventh never turned up, and they're not in their quarters. Let's move." They moved. Gideon's heart hammered in her ears. Her rapier swung against her leg as persistently as the rain peppering the walls of Canaan House. By instinct, Gideon led them through a row of dark, dismal antechambers, door handles slippery with rain, and out into the storm itself, the conservatory where Dulcinea liked to sit. It was stultifyingly hot and muggy in there, like walking into the jaws of a panting animal. Rain sleeted off the plecs in sky-obscuring sheets. Beyond the conservatory door, under an awning that had long since tipped into the rain, was Dulcinea. She was sprawled across the wet flagstones. Her crutches lay on either side of her, as though they had slipped from her grasp. Gideon's insides interlaced, lungs into kidneys into bowels, then rubber-banded back with a twang. It was Camilla who first dropped to her knees beside her and rolled her over on her back. A bruise popped on her temple, and her clothes had soaked right through, as though she had been lying there for hours. There was a terrible bluish tinge to her face. Dulcinea gave an enormous, tearing, terrible cough, pink spittle foaming from her mouth. Her chest jerked staccato. It was not a pretty sight, but Gideon welcomed it with open arms.
"He never came back," she said hopelessly, and fainted.
Chapter 23 Protesilaus the Seventh was missing.
Dulcinea Septimus was critically ill. Left stranded when her cavalier failed to return, then threatened by the rain, she had tried to walk by herself and slipped. Now she was confined to bed with hot cloths on her chest and no good to anybody. Teacher moved her to one of the tiny rooms in the priest wing, and she had to be laid on her side so that whatever was choking her lungs could drain out of her mouth and into a basin. Teacher's two nameless colleagues sat with her, replacing the basin and boiling noisy kettles. Everyone else, the second house with their brass buttons, the twins of the third and their now bouffant cavalier, the fourth teenagers, gimlet-eyed, and the fifth asleep forever in the mortuary, the sixth in grey in the mismatched eighth, and the ninth, with her o roused and tight-lipped in her spare habit, was accounted for. The ashes in the incinerator had been raked out and combed over, and the confirmation that they were human remains was not illuminating. The surviving necromancers had gathered around a bowl of them, and they had all pounced on it like a bowl of peanuts at a party. Only Coronabeth disdained fingering a bunch of smuts and crumblings. "They're much older than they ought to be," said Ianthe Tridentarius, cool as a cucumber, which was the first sign of hope for Protesilaus. "I would have said these belonged to a corpse 3 months dead."
"You're out by about 8 weeks," said Palamedes, brow furrowed, "which would still predate us significantly."
"Well, in either case, it's not him. Has anyone else died?"
"Teacher?"
"We have not held a funeral in a very long time," said Teacher a bit prissily, "and at any rate, we certainly would not have consigned them to the waste incinerator."
"Interesting you should say them."
Ianthe had two small fragments on her palms. One of them was recognizably part of a tooth. For some reason, this dental fact had Hero looking at Ianthe's palms, then Ianthe, then Ianthe's palms again, as though both were suddenly the most fascinating things in the world. Gideon recognized this sudden diamond focus. Herohark was re-estimating a threat. Ianthe said idly,
"You see, there's at least two people in there."
"But the time signature's consistent throughout the remains."
She tipped both fragments into the palms of Palamedes.
"Happy birthday," she said. "They must have died at the same time."
Captain Deuteros said tersely, "The incinerator is a snare. I'm as curious as anyone to know what's in there, but the fact remains that Protesilaus is evidently not. So where is he?"
"I have set the servants to find him," said the first house priest. "They will search every nook and cranny apart from your rooms, which I ask you to search yourselves on the bizarre chance that Protesilaus the Seventh is there. I will not breach the facility, nor will my servants. If you want to go down there, you must go down there yourselves, and then there is the outside of the tower. But if he left the tower, the water is very deep."
Corona turned her chair around and straddled the seat, crossing her slim ankles at the front. Gideon noticed that she and Ianthe had not entirely made up in the wake of whatever fight they must have had. Their chairs were close together, but their bodies were angled away from each other. Corona shook her head again, as though to clear it of cobwebs.
"He must be alive. There's no motive. He was... I mean... Any time I met him, I thought
he was perhaps the most boring man alive," supplied her twin languidly, wiping her hands. Corona flinched. "And not even a classic Seventh House ball. He hasn't subjected us to even one minimalist poem about cloud formations."
"Consider this. Maybe there's no motive," said Jean-Marie Chateau, who refused to sheathe her rapier.
She had positioned herself and Isaac nearly back to back, as though united they could take all comers.
"Consider this. They went through the hatch, just like Magnus and Abigail, and now he's dead and she's about to kick the bucket."
Would the fourth drop this insane monster theory?
Not insane, said Teacher to Nibirius. Oh no, not insane.
Captain Deuterus, who had been scribbling in her notepad, leant back in her chair and tossed down her pencil.
I'd like to supply a more human mens rea. Yes, the Duchess Septimus and her cavalier had accessed the facility. Did they have any keys?
Yes, said a voice at the door.
Gideon hadn't noticed the chainmail-skirted, whitewashed figure of Silas Octokizeron leave, but she noticed him come back in. He entered the eating atrium from the kitchen side, looking pallid and unruffled, his bladed face as pitiless as ever, free from a normal human emotion.
Yes, she does, he repeated. Or rather, she did.
What the hell did you just do? Said Palamedes quietly.
Your aggression is unseemly and unwarranted, said Silas. I went to see her. I felt a certain responsibility. I was the one who asked for satisfaction, and Brother Asht had been ready to duel her missing cavalier. I did not want bad blood between us. I feel nothing but pity for the Seventh House, Warden Sextus.
You haven't answered my question.
Silas felt about in his pocket and raised his hand to display its contents. It was one of the iron keyrings, and on it were two keys, one grey, one a familiar white.
If foul play has befallen her cavalier, he said in his curiously deep voice, then the culprit will get no joy of it. I found her conscious, keeping hold of this. She's surrendered it to me for safekeeping.
That's dubious in the extreme, said Captain Deuteros. Surrender them to me now in a show of good faith, Master Silas, if you please.
I cannot, in good conscience, until I know the fate of Protesilaus the Seventh. Anyone here could be guilty. Brother Asht, here.
The chainmail-kirtled boy tossed the ring to his cavalier, who caught it out of the air and fished his own heavy keyring out of his pocket. Gideon noticed that their ring held a facility key and one other in black wrought iron with curlicues. Column the Eighth locked the two rings together with a very final click.
I'll keep these until such a time as she wants them. Judging by our conversation, that may well be never.
This was received with a brief silence.
You callous bastard, shouted Nibirius. You just went and heavied a nearly dead girl for her keys.
Jean-Marie said, You're just sorry you didn't think of it first.
Chatter, if you say one more bloody word, I'll make sure you never get through puberty. Hold your tongue, Prince Tern, said Captain Deuterus. I have bigger fish to fry than listening to you abuse a child.
She stood. She took them all in, with the face of a woman who had come to a final conclusion.
This is where the tendon meets the bone. This key-hoarding cannot continue. I told you before that the Second House would take responsibility if nobody else had the stomach for it. That begins now.
The slender necromancer, in his pure eighth white, had slid into a chair proffered by his nephew, and he sat straight-backed and thoughtful.
Is that a challenge to me then, Captain? He said sorrowfully.
You'll keep.
The second adept thrust her chin toward Palamedes, who had been sitting with fingers steepled beneath his jaw, staring through the walls as though discord was so intensely distasteful that he could only distance himself from it.
Warden, the sixth is the Emperor's reason. I asked you earlier, and I'm telling you now. Hand over what keys you've won for my safekeeping. The sixth, the Emperor's reason, blinked. With all respect, he said. Piss off. Let the record state that I was forced into a challenge, said Lieutenant Dias,
and she peeled off one white glove. She threw it down on the table, looking Palamedes dead in the eye.
We duel. I name the time, you name the place. The time is now.
Duel the sixth, squawked Jean-Marie.
That's not fair.
A perfect babble broke out. Teacher rose with a curious, resigned expression on his face.
"I will not be party to this,"
he said, as though that was going to stop anyone, and he left the room. In the vacuum of his exit, Corona slapped both of her hands down on the table.
"Judith, you coward! Pick on someone your own size!" "This is what happens, isn't it?"
The bad necromancer teen was in a stupor, still. He sounded wondering, not angry.
"This is what happens with Magnus and Abigail gone."
"Yes, I'm sure Magnus the Fifth would have issued us a strongly worded memorandum."
"Ianthe, not helping. Sixth, you mustn't accept. The Third will represent the Sixth in this, if they'll consent. At arms, Babs!"
Her twin sister's voice was thin and soft as silk.
"Don't unsheathe that sword, Nabarius."
"Ianthe, what are you doing?"
"I want to see how this plays out," she said with a pallid shrug, heedless of the growing ire in her twin's voice. "Alas, I have a bad personality and a stupefying deficit of attention."
"Well, Babs, thank God, has much better sense than to listen to you. Babs?"
Nabirius's hand was hesitating hard on the hilt. He had not sprung into action as proposed, nor had he flanked the commanding twin. He was staring at her pale shadow, knuckles white, hand still, with a resentment very near hate. Corona's smile flickered.
"Babs?"
Through all this, Palamedes had slopped the weight of his head into one hand, then into the other, scrubbing his fingers down his long face. He had taken his glasses off and was tapping the thick frames against the table. His nail-grey stare had not left Judith Deuterus, whose own gaze was as resolute as concrete.
"Default, Warden," said the captain. "You are a good man. Don't put your cavalier through this."
Palamedes seemed to snap out of it all at once, squeaking his chair legs horribly on the tiled floor as he scooted it backward and away from the table's edge.
"No, we're doing this," he said abruptly. "I pick here."
The captain said,
"Sextus, you're mad. Give her some dignity."
He did not even stand, just crooked his fingers at his cavalier. Rather than tensing up in anticipation, as Gideon might have, Camilla had relaxed. She shook her dark fringe off her forehead, shivered out of her hood and her cloak, swung her neck back and forth like someone limbering up to dance.
"Oh, I am," he said.
"Cam?"
Camilla Hecht stepped onto the wooden table with one long, lean movement. She wore a long grey shirt and grey slacks beneath her cloak, and she looked less like a cavalier than an off-duty librarian. Still, this startled her audience, except for Lieutenant Dias, who vaulted up to the opposite side of the table, which creaked crossly beneath the strain. Dias had not bothered to take off her jacket. She slid her utilitarian and bone-sharp knife out of its cross-hip sheath and laid it there for display. With her main hand she drew her rapier, plain-hilted, polished until it hurt. The Sixth stared at her for a moment, as though she had no idea of the protocol. And then she drew both of her weapons at once in a way that nagged at the back of Gideon's brain. The rapier looked, like Gideon's, maybe a million years old. It was the first time she had seen it in a good light, and here it looked as though it had never been designed to take an edge blow. The blade was light and delicate as a cobweb. The offhand looked like Camilla's whole house had gone searching down the back of the sofa for weapons. They had come up with what looked more like a long hunting or hacking knife than a dueling dagger. Thick, meaty, cross-guarded, with a single sharpened edge. The whole effect was sadly amateurish. The lovely and miserable Corona Beth had shouldered forward to stand at the table too, positioned in the space between them. She called to Judith and Palamedes.
"Clerf to sack?" "Hyoid down. Disarm legal. Necromancer's mercy," said the second's necromancer calmly.
Corona Beth sucked a breath through her teeth.
Sextus, do you agree to the terms?
I have no idea what any of that means, said Palamedes.
Gideon drew forward to them, leaning in to hear Corona saying in an urgent whisper,
Warden, that means she can hit your cavalier anywhere below the neck, and it ends only when you give in. She's being an absolute cad, and I'm not even slightly sorry for pantsing her when we were 8.
Nor should you be.
Don't let her make an example of you, said the princess. She's picking on you because you can't fight back, like a bully kicking a dog. She's given herself leeway to hurt your cavalier very badly, and she will, just to scare Octokizeron and Nona Jesimus. No offence, Ninth.
The warden of the 6th drummed his feet on the floor percussively. He said,
So you're saying her cavalier can do more or less anything to my cavalier, all in the name of making me cry uncle?
Yes.
From across the table, Captain Deuteros said sternly,
No more waiting. Default or fight. Corona, if you insist on arbitrating, arbitrate.
Those exquisite eyes would have persuaded a stone to roll uphill, but finding no purchase with Palamedes, Corona raised her voice reluctantly.
To the mercy call. Hyoid down. The neck is no exception. Point, blade, ricasso off hand. Call.
Marta the 2nd, called Lieutenant Dias.
Camilla did not call. She looked down at her necromancer and said,
Warden?
You can't hit her in the head, he said. I think. I choose when you're done.
Just tell me how to play it.
Camilla raised her voice.
Camilla the 6th!
Gideon had moved back to her necromancer. Everyone else in the room looked grave. For a moment, she thought the 4th were holding hands, but she realized Isaac was holding Jean-Marie back. His hand around her wrist was a clamp, and her face the picture of outrage. There were bleakly hungry faces, the pale Ianthe and Nibirius licking his lips. And then there were the 8th, who were filling their own bingo sheet by praying. Herohark looked as taut and distant as a hangman's rope. But something in Gideon's face must have caught her attention. She went from distant to bemused, and from bemused to something even a little bit offended. Gideon couldn't blame her. The general atmosphere was of a disapproving crowd before an execution, but she was trying and failing to smother a grin of savage anticipation. Corona was saying, 2 paces back. Can't turn, damn. This is so hard to do on a table.
Come, Palamedes said. Go loud.
And begin, said Corona Beth.
Gideon had to give Dias her due. It took her much less time than it had taken Gideon, fighting Nibiria's turn, for the 2nd to realize she was in trouble. Lieutenant Marta Dias was, in every line of her, a smart, efficient fighter, not given to folderol or showboating, at the very peak of her fitness. Unlike the 3rd, she was a soldier, far more used to fighting people who weren't moving to a playbook of legal dueling moves. She had trained her whole life with the front in mind, with veterans and bloodthirsty recruits. Her sword arm was balanced and light, her posture neat but not starchy. She was incredibly reactive, ready for any gambit her opponent could bring.
Camilla hit her like a hurricane. She exploded forward with her rapier wide and her butcher's knife held close, knocking the lieutenant's hurried parry out the way and sliding away from a belated lunge with the dagger. She sliced a red gouge down Dias's immaculate white jacket and shirt, bashed her across the knuckles with the hilt of her rapier, and kicked her in the knee for good measure. The kick was Cam's only mistake. The pain clearly set every neuron in Dias's body shrieking with adrenaline. Someone like Nibirius would have been prone on the table from shock, probably bleating and shitting. But the 2nd kept her wits about her. She took the pain with a stagger, kept her footing, and held her blade, and parried another sweeping blow from Camilla's knife. She moved back for breathing space, Camilla harassing her with strike after strike to get back inside her guard until she could move no more.
She was, after all, fighting on a table. Camilla's foot lashed out to her offhand, and the dagger clattered to the ground. The second, with an honestly beautiful dodge and a perfect reaction, took her one opportunity and lunged. Dias was desperate, and Dias was of the second house. Cam fought like a grease fire, but she left herself too many openings. Dias's thrust would have pierced a lesser fighter right beneath the collarbone and run her through. It caught Camilla Hecht low in the right forearm as she nearly dodged it, piercing the meat next to the ulna and making her snarl. She dropped her cobweb-light rapier, grabbed Marta's wrist and yanked. The arm dislocated with a bright pop. Lieutenant Dias didn't quite scream, but she got most of the way there. She windmilled at the edge of the table. Still holding the wrist, Camilla stepped past her, kicked her legs out almost dismissively, and drove her down face first into the wooden boards with a crunch. This left Camilla standing over her opponent, one foot pressed into the back of her neck, the dislocated arm pinned up at an angle that looked seriously uncomfortable. Dias made a strangled, agonized noise, and Judith Deuteros snapped, "Mercy!"
"Mercy called, match to the sixth," said Corona Beth, as though saying it faster would make it over sooner.
There was silence, except for Camilla's ragged breathing and the lieutenant's tiny, half-amazed gasps. Then Jean-Marie said,
"Hot dog!"
Both cavaliers were oozing blood. It dripped from Camilla's wound where the sword had stuck her, and it was soaking through Lieutenant Dias's shirt and dribbling from her nose, the exact same colour as her neckerchief. She had her eyes screwed up tightly. Palamedes was already standing beside the table, and, with another excruciating noise, he set Marta's arm back inside its joint. This time she really did scream. Captain Deuteros watched, face absolutely blank.
"Your keys," he said. "I don't have."
"Then your facility key.
Hand it over." "You have its exact copy."
Palamedes rounded on her with a sudden fury that made everyone jump, even Gideon.
"Then maybe I'll throw it out the fucking window," he snarled. "Two good calves hurt, yours and mine, all because the second tried to beat up the weak kid first."
He jabbed a finger at Judith's immaculate waistcoat with intent to impale. She didn't flinch.
"You have no idea how many keys we're holding. You have no idea how many keys anybody's holding, because you haven't paid any damn attention since the shuttles landed. You picked on us because the sixth aren't fighters. You could have fought Gideon the ninth or Column the eighth. You fought Camilla because you wanted a quick win, and you didn't even watch her first. You just assumed you could take her. And I can't stand people who assume." "I had cause," said the second doggedly. "I don't care," said Palamedes. "Isn't it funny how it took the second of all houses to blow this whole thing open? You stuck a target on the back of everyone toting a key. It's a free-for-all now, and it's your fault, and you'll pay for it." "For God's sake, Warden, you misunderstand my intention. Give me your key, Captain," roared the scion of the sixth. "Or is the second faithless as well as dense?" "Here," said Lieutenant Dias.
She had mopped most of the blood away from her mouth and nose, although her once white shirt was drenched with scarlet. She fumbled in her jacket pocket with her unhurt arm and held out a keyring, adorned with a single key. Palamedes gave her a curt nod, plucked it from her fingers, and turned his back on them both. Camilla was sitting on the edge of the table, her hand clapped over her wound, blood seeping freely from between her fingers.
"Missed the bone," she said.
"Remember that you're using a rapier, please."
"I'm not making excuses, but she was quick as hell."
A voice interrupted.
"I challenge the six for their keys. I name the time, and the time is now."
Chapter 24 Everyone's heads followed the sound. except for Ianthe Tridentarius, who was lounging in her chair with one eyebrow raised, and Nibirius Tern, who had issued the challenge. He vaulted to the table in one lustrous movement, swinging himself up to stand on it, even as Judith Deuteros very carefully eased her cavalier down into an empty seat. He looked down at them all with a hard sneer, and the one stupid curl that he always managed to get right in the middle of his forehead.
"No, you don't," said Corona Beth faintly.
"Yes, he does," said Ianthe, rising to stand. "You need a facility key, don't you? Here's our chance. I suspect we won't be given a better." There was an expression of grim alarm rising on Judith Deuteros's face. She had both hands across the oozing slit on her cavalier's chest, and she had paused in her work out of sheer annoyance.
"You have no cause," she said.
"Neither did you, if we're all being honest with ourselves. Sextus was perfectly right."
"If you want to cast me as the villain, do it," said the captain. "I'm trying to save our lives. You're giving in to chaos. There are rules, Third."
"On the contrary," Ianthe said, "you've amply demonstrated that there are no rules whatsoever. There's only the challenge and how it's answered." When she looked at her sister's stricken face, Corona was somewhere beyond fury and shame now and had lost every atom of her poise. She only said, quite softly, "This is for you, dear. Don't be picky. This may be the only chance we have. Don't feel bad, sweetheart. What can you do?" Corona's face changed. The struggle gave way to exhaustion, but at the same time, there was a weird relief in her. Her teeth were gritted, but one of her hands tangled in her sister's long, thin, ivory-blonde locks, and she drew their heads close.
"I can do nothing," she said,
and Gideon realized they'd just lost her somehow. "Then let's do this together. I need you."
"I need you," echoed her twin, rather piteously.
Camilla hauled herself up to stand. She had taken Palamedes's handkerchief and bound her arm, but the blood was already showing through, and she held it in a funny way. Palamedes looked close to vibrating out of